Okay, Jesus was a great storyteller. And amongst his stories, one of the most popular is the prodigal son. Most people, I suspect, do not know the meaning of the word prodigal. The only time they ever use the word prodigal is when they talk about the parable of the prodigal son. It's not kind of a word you drop in your essays, although I'd commend it to you. It will generally win favour amongst the academics that somebody actually knows a word that has that many syllables in it. It's helpful if you can spell it correctly. It might do you a world of good. But I would commend to you that you check out the dictionary first. Because, like I say, most people don't know what the word means. It's just a word that you use in associations with son when reading Luke 15. I won't ask you to tell us, but hands up those who are confident that they know what the word prodigal means. And this is a modern English translation. There's a problem, isn't it? Well, if none of us are too confident, who would like to have a guess at what prodigal means? That's all right, you see, you don't know. Yeah. Rebellious coming back? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good guess. You can see where he gets it from, not the dictionary, but from the context. And you know where dictionaries get it from? The context. So it's a good way of thinking, yeah? Okay. Yeah. Any other guesses? Prodigious means greatly, so maybe it means spending lots of money. That's a good way of thinking also, because dictionaries also get it just from the context, but from the context elsewhere and from the roots of the word, so it could mean that, couldn't it? Spending lots of money.
Lost?
Good guess. And lost has got about as many letters as prodigal as syllables, you know? Yeah? A lost son? Well, there we go. There we go. Well, little dictionary work for you all to do when you get home tonight. Okay, it means wasteful, extravagant, recklessly extravagant is what it means. Someone who throws their money away. Doesn't care for it. And so prodigious is part of the roots of that word. It's a similar parallel word, yes. To be prodigal. As far as I know, it's the only place the word is much used these days. This wasteful, extravagant. Well, that just shows how popular the story is, in a sense, doesn't it? It's popular for lots of reasons. It's popular because it's a beautiful story. It's popular because the way it's recorded for us in Luke's Gospel, and it's only in Luke's Gospel, it's not in the other Gospels. Interesting, I mean, you get the parable of the sower is in several of the Gospels, but this one's just only in Luke. It's told beautifully, isn't it? It's a well-crafted story. It's graphic and it's simple. But I think it's also popular because it's so memorable. It's once told, never forgotten kind of story, which is indicative of being a good story, that it is once told, never forgotten. But it's also a pain for any of you who have ever taught Sunday school to children, because as soon as you get to this lesson and you start teaching them, they say, oh, I know that one already. And it is almost impossible to teach anyone over the age of 3 the prodigal son, because they know it. It's that kind of story which just grabs the imagination, and once grabbed, it sticks in the memory, and you just know the parable, don't you? It is a beautiful story, magnificently told, but I think also its popularity is because it's so personal. That is, we can all identify with the characters in it, can't we? We can all identify with the father and his anxieties, his worries, and his love, and his joy. You know, if you have a father, he acts like you'd want your father to act, doesn't he? If you're ever in the situation of being the prodigal son, and if you ever turned up in order to be the servant in the household because you'd be better off than serving in a foreign land, if your father should welcome you back as a child and say, come on in and have a party and be part of the family again, that's exactly what you would want your father to do, isn't it? And so you hear the story and you say, yes, that's... But you also hear the story and you say, yeah, I know prodigals. I can identify with him. I've goofed off too. I may not have goofed off in big scale like he did, but then I haven't been given a third of the estate yet. But with a little bit that I have got, my capacity for making stupid decisions, for wasting my time, for wasting my opportunity, for borrowing Dad's car and driving like a lunatic and a maniac, for wrecking up things, you can identify with the prodigal fairly easily, can't we? That, and not just that, but you can identify with other people that you know have gone the full whole hog like he has, if you don't mind the use of the word hog in relationship to a man who wound up feeding pigs. Who has gone, you know, you can think of it. I was chatting to a friend just a while back, and he was telling me, I mean, he's a great man, he's a minister of the gospel in England these days, but he told me about his time at university. He said in his first year of university, he was going into the military to be an army officer, and the army was paying for him to go to university and paying him a salary while he was at university. And he said in his first year at university, it was just a party from one end to the other. He just went from one party to another. He drank and partied his way through the whole academic year. And he paid for the party because he was the only person who was getting a full salary living in college. And so he ran through the whole month. At the end of the year, he didn't have any money left from the salary he'd earned entertaining all his friends in college. And at the end of the year, he and the army parted company, partly because of his academic progress, partly, of course, when he went away on some army camps, he decided he didn't want to be an army officer. That was rather stupid. And so they had a long sit-down talk, and they decided that he would leave the army and over the next X years would repay the year's scholarship that he had and the money that he'd had. And so he was therefore, rather than just not having money, he was then deep in debt. And he said in the second year, he found that he didn't get invited to any parties, and he didn't have any friends. And whereas he was the life of the college in first year, nobody gave the slightest concern for him. And he was alone and lost and feeling utterly miserable. And the prodigal son, it's just such a true story, isn't it? You hear it happening and you can say, yeah, I know somebody who's came from that home and they just went berserk. I know somebody who dropped out with drugs. I know somebody who dropped out. Several of my contemporaries, I remember young people, they're still there, a couple of them. They went surfing. They've never come back. You know, my age, still bottle blonde and knobs on the knees and the top of the feet because they just went surfing. They just got in the culture and dropped out. And their parents' hearts were broken. Their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations for their kids, they just became beach bums. And 30 years later, one of them still is. He's never done anything in his life except just hung around beaches, trying to catch the perfect wave. Pathetic, really. You can relate to it. I mean, you can know the prodigals, can't you? And we've all known in others, if not felt in ourselves, that twinge of envy, of jealousy, of righteous hurt, like the older brother. And you get it, don't you, when others less deserving than you have received honour before you, where others got selected to be the school prefect when you really did everything and they didn't do anything for the school, and they got honoured in terms of being called up in front of the rest of the school for this, and they've actually been given the option of going ahead. They're the ones who got invited to the party, they're the ones who got invited to the ball, they're the ones who, the formal, they're the ones who... They're the envy, the jealousy, the rivalry, the sense of disappointment at other people's victories. That they got the high distinction and you really did the work. That they You don't have to live for many years before you see the story of the prodigal son. You'll see it enacted before your eyes as some young fool wastes everything of their family and goes missing. But let's stop and look at Luke 15 as a whole, so as to make sure that we've understood this story correctly. Because we might have misunderstood it. It's a simple enough story. It's a straightforward story. But you'll only capture it properly if you check its context, always. So what's the context of the parable of the prodigal son? Well, the chapter has not one story, but three parables and an introduction. The introduction's there in verses 1 and 2, and it sets the scene for all three parables. It's about tax collectors and sinners, and it's about Pharisees and law teachers. You see, the tax collectors and sinners are those who are publicly immoral. The tax collectors were not quite like the bureaucratic grey civil servants of our modern tax officers. The tax collectors of the ancient world were corrupt, thoroughly and utterly. In order to get the job as a tax collector, you basically had to bribe the Roman government to give it to you. And you spent your first year as tax officer generally paying off the bribes that it took to get you into your position as tax collector. But the second and third year of your time as tax collector, you certainly made up for it because of the extortionate rates of tax that you set upon the populace around about you. You basically ripped everybody off. But the worst feature of it was something else for the Jew. That is, you collected taxes from the Jews in order to pay the Romans to oppress your own nation. So they were collaborators with the enemies. They were traitors. They were oppressors. They were corrupt. It's really not much going for a tax collector in Palestine in the first century. Here are the people who have gathered around to hear Jesus. Public, notorious sinners. Tax collectors. But the accusation is not just that they came to hear him, which the passage tells us they do in verse 1, but the accusation of verse 2 is that he eats with them. That is, he fellowships with them. He makes friends with them. He associates himself with them. He is one of them. He hangs around with degenerates. He accepts them. The other group that you see there are the Pharisees and the law teachers. The Pharisees were the public moral people. We know them from Bible reading as the hypocrites. And they were hypocritical. But they were known by themselves and by their contemporaries as the moral people. The religious people, the upright people, the good people. There was a movement amongst lay people who were particularly concerned for separation. Separation from everything that was contaminating and evil in this world. Separation from collaboration with the Romans, for example. They were going to be the pure, holy people of Israel. And they called upon people to so obey the law that we would live a separate life from the rest of the world. That in many ways is good and noble and admirable and what the law calls upon us to be like. And the Israelites, the Pharisees in particular, had scribes, that is, teachers of the law, who would scour the first five books of the Old Testament to make sure that their lifestyle was consistent with their claim to be the people of God. Now they, you'll notice, muttered. It's a lovely word in English, isn't it? Mutter, 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 mutter. It has that kind of grumbling discontent. It's not that they were just saying it. They were saying it, but the Greek word actually is more than they were saying. They're muttering amongst themselves. You know that kind of grizzle complaint kind of noise that happens with people about the establishment, about the authorities. You hear people complaining about the university authorities or the college authorities or the college food. It's the mutter. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." So the introduction sets the scene and the theme of all three parables. It's a theme of this grumbling discontent from these Pharisees about the sinners and tax collectors that Jesus accepted them. And so he tells them three stories. And all three stories are about being lost, being found, and the resultant joy. So verses 3 to 7 is about the lost sheep. Verses 8 to 10 is about the lost coin. And verse 11 through to the end of the chapter is about the lost son. And rather than the prodigal son, seeing we don't know what it means, the NIV calls it the parable of the lost son, which may be a better description of it, because it's not just that he's prodigal, throwing away extravagantly, wasting the resources, but he is lost to his father. But of course other people would say it's the parable of the two sons, or the parable of the elder son, or the parable of the lost sons. Because the reason for telling of the lost coin, sheep, son, is to actually tell you and to speak of the finding. The stories are really about sons being found, coins being found, sheep being found. It's not just about the loss, devastation, destruction, end, but actually you're being told they're lost in order to be told they're found. Yet even that is not the point of the stories. The point of the stories is not that they are lost, nor that they are found. The point of the stories is joy. The joy in finding that which is lost. And so if you wanted to give a kind of title for the stories, it's something like The Joy in Finding the Lost. Look with me, just to kind of ram home the point here for a moment. Verse 5, when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders. Verse 6, and goes home, then he calls his friends and neighbours together and says, rejoice with me that I found my... Verse 7, I tell you that in the same way there will be rejoicing in heaven over the one. Or verse 9, and when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbours together and says, rejoice to me. Verse 10, in the same way I tell you there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Or verse 23, bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. Or 24, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Or 29, but he answered his father, look at all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me a young goat so that I could celebrate with my friends. Or verse 32, but we have to celebrate and be glad because this your brother who is dead and is alive again was lost and is found. It's about celebration, it's about joy, it's about the happiness, it's about the excitement, it's about the pleasure of finding that which is lost. Rejoice, celebrate. There is great joy, there is great excitement at rediscovering, of finding again. There's overwhelming emotions, aren't there? The Sudan is a particularly dirty and unpleasant warfare being waged for a long, long time. All of your lifetime, there has been a war in the nation, in the country that is called the Sudan. The northern half of the Sudan, the Muslim government, has been at war with the southern half, which is mainly a Christian nation. And it has been a barbaric and awful war. And one of the characteristics around the war zone between the two parts is the Muslim slave traders have been operating, stealing and taking children, young children away, and putting them into slavery. There is an organisation now operating, purchasing back the children of the Christians out of slavery in order to return them to their families. Now that is an awful part of the world. It is an awful part of story. It's an awful part of life which you won't read in our newspapers because it is politically incorrect to mention that people would do such things like that. And you can't say anything negative about Muslims, and so we don't actually hear anything about these things that are happening in the Sudan and have been happening for a long time. But friends, just put yourself in the picture for a minute or two. Just capture the moment that the organisation that is working to rescue these children go through from time to time when they bring home a child that was lost. Can you imagine the overwhelming sense of emotions that would race through you as a mother, as a father, as a brother, as a sister, when your little one comes home, freed? I mean, you'd be worried about the grandparents having a heart attack out of sheer joy, wouldn't you? You'd have to kind of do it gently, wouldn't you? And there would be whatever, I mean, having parties is always a waste of money. It's always prodigal to have a party, isn't it? a sensible bean-counting accountant would have no parties. Parties have always got to do with a sense of extravagance, a sense of eating the things you don't need to eat. You shouldn't eat. I mean, if a party is made up of the kind of food that you should eat, it's not much of a party, is it? The very nature of a party is the fattened calf. Not much fun for vegetarians. Really? And again, I won't pursue this further. However, you see, here is the time that if you're ever going to lash out, this is the moment to lash out, isn't it? I mean, with a little one back, safe after years of being away, why, call in the friends, call in the family, ring up everybody that is available to know, contact them, send out the bush telegraph up there, it's mainly the desert telegraph. Send it out, find out everybody, come and see they're alive, see they're well, see they're happy, come and eat with us, come and rejoice with us, come and stay for a week with us. That is the time, isn't it? That's the kind of thing that is caught here. The joy of finding the lost. It's not just that they're found. It's not just that he's accepted back this prodigal. It's that the father becomes prodigal at that point. In fact, the eldest son is complaining about the father being prodigal. You're wasting a good fattened calf on this no good brother. On this no good son of yours, actually what he says. You're being prodigal, just like him. No wonder he's prodigal. Father like you. He can't see that this is the moment of joy and happiness and celebration and pleasant and excitement and partying. And so there is that other emotion that's in the passage. The ugly emotion. The dark, disturbing, inappropriate, negative emotion that is there in verse 28. The older brother became angry, churlish. Refused to go in. Spit the dummy country, isn't it? I've been slaving for you. What an attitude to being his father's elder son living in the estate with his father. I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed your orders. And this son of yours, verse 30, can't bring himself to use the name, can't bring himself to call him his brother. Here is petty, self-centered, self-righteous jealousy and envy, which is so detestable in anybody else and so close to the surface in some of us, isn't it? But it's not something we would ever like or acknowledge or want, but it's there. It understands nothing of the Father's love. He understands nothing of his father's anxiety and worry and heartache. Ah, friends, to talk to parents whose children have gone off the rails. To see people in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s sobbing in tears because of the stupidity of their teenage kids. This boy knows nothing of his father's anxiety. He has no sympathy, no appreciation of the horror his father has gone through, worrying at nights, where is he? Is he alive? Is he being ripped off? Is he being bashed up? Has he? Nothing of that. No sympathy for his father's delight in the brother safely home. And he has no delight in his brother either. He doesn't even go in to see his brother. This son of yours. Notice how the father talks of him in verse 32. This brother of yours. I hope you're getting on well with your brothers and sisters of your own family. For they are your brother and they are your sister. Now there is a relationship that you have by the creation of God, which is very important. And there are very few joys in life greater than to live with your siblings in harmony and peace and love. And there are very few relationships that are more cruel and difficult than when you fall out with your siblings. this brother of yours? So from Luke 15, I take it we have two words. A word to tax collectors and sinners, and a word to Pharisees and law teachers. Firstly, to tax collectors and sinners. The word of God, the word of the gospel to you is to come home. Come to your senses and come home. Return while you may. This is the call of the shepherd for the lost sheep. This is the sweeping of the woman looking for the lost coin, that you should be here this night to be reminded yet again of this passage, which I guess most of us have known from way back when. We can't even remember it was ever first told to us. I don't know what you've done. I don't know where you've been. I don't know what you've thought. I don't know how guilty you are. But I know the message of God is come home. I know the message is to come to your senses and return while you can. I know the message is that Jesus has so paid the penalty for you that you will be welcomed home. To return to God is not to return to go to the prison sentence. The prison sentence has been paid for by Jesus. To return to God is return to the family who will welcome you as if you have disappeared, as if you had been taken away, as if you had been kidnapped, as if you had been lost. The joy in heaven, the joy of God, will be astonishing to you when you come home. Who are you? I don't know. But I guess in this building, this night, just by statistics and who we are sitting here now, you can be someone who has stolen from shops, from insurance companies, from your parents, from friends. You can be people who have cheated. Cheated in your exams, cheated the taxation department, cheated the computer companies. You can be people who have lied about other people, spread malicious gossip, created it, lied to other people yourself. You can be drunks, people who already have got a real problem, people who have abused substances. See the age of you, there can't help but be those of you who have been sexual users of other people and abusers of other people. You can be somebody who is being used by other people. You've got deep regrets for what you've done and what was done to you. You can be amongst those who have sold themselves physically for money. You can be amongst those who have sold themselves physically for popularity. You can be those whose family life has been one that has involved incest. You know the guilt of what you have done to your sister, your brother, or feel the guilt of what other relatives have done to you. You can have so hated people as to wish them dead. You won't be the first person who has sat in our church and who was actually physically murdered. I don't know where you've run to. I don't know how lost you are. God knows. And you may not. Notice what happened to him? Verse 17. He had to come to his senses. See, my friend in England, the whole of his first year at university, he never once came to his senses. He just partied off. He just blew his money. the army's money. It wasn't until his second year, when his friends had run out with his money, that he came to his senses. God knows. Have you yet come to your senses enough to know yourselves? For he is tonight giving you a chance back. That's more than just a chance back. It's a welcome back. That's more than a welcome back. It's the joyous, exciting, exuberant, overwhelming of love. The sheer pleasure that will light up heaven itself when you come home. For he wants you home like a father who has lost his child. He wishes to have you. And when one like you comes home, you will find more joy surrounding you from God's family and from God himself than you would ever imagine, and that you will ever receive from those ne'er good friends who are happy to live off your money and desert you when it runs out. In a little while, I'm going to give you an opportunity to come home. I'm going to help you come home. You see, the fellow makes it very clear here, doesn't he? He says, I will rise and go to my father. And I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven, against you. No more worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your servants. You can't go home without a change of mind. You can't go home without a losing of face. Heaven against you. No more worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your servants. You can't go home without a change of mind. You can't go home without a losing of face. You can't go home without a admission of failure. And sometimes some people know they've done the wrong thing, know they don't want to be there, too pig-headed to actually say sorry, to actually say I got it wrong, to actually say I goofed. It's one thing to be stupid, but it really is another thing to continue in stupidity because you're stupid. And that really is dumb, isn't it? To be too proud to admit your error. And yet, what we're like, isn't it? Unless we come to our senses. But if you come to your senses, if you can see that it really is, you need to come home. Then we're going to pray a prayer in a little while, a few minutes, because I haven't seen the second word yet, only the first word to tax collectors and sinners. But over the back, you'll see down the bottom of the outline down here, there is that prayer that I usually finish the Sunday night with. And you'll see that first paragraph of the prayer, Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be accepted by you, is just like the prodigal coming to his senses, isn't it? I'm no longer worthy to be called yours. I need forgiveness. If you know that's where you're at, don't bother listening to the rest of the sermon. Sit and read that prayer and think about it for a while, because in a minute or two we'll come back to it and I'll lead you in it. But I want you to have thought about it. But that's what you want to pray. But that's how you want to come back. Because if you're going to come back like that, you've got to take action, haven't you? So there's no good sitting down there amongst the pigs and say, I'll arise and go to my father and I'll say to him this, and then continuing to sit there amongst the pigs. You actually then have to get up and leave, don't you? And so if we're going to pray a prayer like that, we're going to have to change. And so we'll need to talk with each other about it and see how we can help you. But there's another group here, and so if you're not going to be praying that prayer tonight because you're already back in the family, or you think you're back in the family, or you're not lost, well, what about the Pharisees and the law teachers? The second word. Because there'll be some here who have very little sympathy for prodigals and don't actually have all that much joy in their return. A man I know, his father was an alcoholic and bashed him fairly frequently when he was a young man. My friend became a Christian, started praying for his father's conversion. But then when his father started showing interest in Christianity, my friend discovered that he didn't really want his father converted at all, because he wanted his father punished. He had to wrestle very hard at this point. He's a prodigal, like I was a prodigal. I loved it when I came home and I was welcomed back. I don't want my father to come home and be welcomed back. The Pharisees always have got hypocrisy written into them, haven't they? A word then to the Pharisees, to the law teachers amongst us. If you think your standing before God is morality, is your religious observance, is your self-achievement, is that the fact that you are not like one of the prostitutes and the drunks, the drug addicts and the criminals of our society, if you're the kind of person who is a moral, good, upright person, a member of your local Apex Lions and Rotary, if you've been able to look after yourself and your family and lived with a certain moral integrity so that you are satisfied with yourself and the standards that you have in life, then can I suggest to you, with all due humility that I can muster, but as much force as I can muster, that you're as lost as the prodigal. In fact, unlike him, you don't even perceive your need. You do not repent of your ways, and you will not receive the joy of God's welcome home. My friend, you may see and disapprove of the degeneracy of a prodigal, of the shamelessness, of the immorality of a society. But stop and look at your own need. Your own heartlessness, your own lack of real loving relationship with God. You may be able to hear about the gay Mardi Gras and people see people's sensuous exhibitions and say, isn't it disgusting? But have you worried about them and the horror of the lifestyle that they are going through and the agonies of their lives? This week I had to go visiting hospital fairly frequently during the last week up at King's Cross. The hospital is just at the back streets of King's Cross, and you walk around King's Cross and you see the utter lostness of people that are there. The terrible, terrible pain that is in their lives, living out of bags, living on the streets, living in old, filthy, dirty clothes, living in the derelict state of alcoholism. People who look 70 or 80, but when you get to talk to them, you find out they're 35 and 40 because of the harshness of the experience of life they have. You walk past the prostitutes, one that I saw as I walked past, blotted out of her mind with this vacant look on her face, the sheer boredom of another one just waiting for men that have been coming along there. You see the horror of the society that's around about you, but if you do not long for their recovery, if you do not rejoice in the hope that you might be able to have them in your home as friends, if you cannot sit with them in the gutter of the street that they are, then you may be more lost than they are. For you're further away from the heart of God. For the heart of God is to long for the lost. The heart of God is to send his Son into the world to pay the penalty for the lost. The heart of God is to live by truth that looks upon your lies and deceit and subtleties and cunning, your self-centeredness and your hatreds, your petty envies and jealousies and rivalries, and sees in them as much rebellion against God as the shameless wickedness that is out there in the streets to see, and sees in you the same lostness that he sees in them. But you, because of your success in this world, because that you can dress yourself and feed yourselves and drive around in nice cars and live within homes and have relationships and family and friends who are all nice to you, and you have gone to all the self-esteem kind of classes that enables you to be sufficiently self-assertive, you do not need God. When in fact, you don't even know how much you need him. The elder brother winds up further away from God than the younger brother when he was down there amongst the pigs. Stop and look at your own need, your own heartlessness, your own lack of real relationship with God. Stop and see that the prodigal is not as lost as you are. Come to your senses and come home also. And when you come home, you don't expect a party as big as the prodigal, do you? That's your problem. To get you home will give a bigger party than the prodigal. If you think it's a miracle to get a prodigal back to God, it is a double miracle to get a Pharisee back to God. That'll be the biggest party of all time, to get someone who's self-righteous admitting that they're wrong. Somebody who knows he's wrong has some chance of overcoming the stupidity of pride that admit he's goofed off. But someone who won't even acknowledge they're wrong, you never get them to see. No, no, heaven will really light up when you who are that lost will come home. The parable of the prodigal son, or the two sons, or the elder son, or the lost sons, the parable may be the greatest story Jesus ever told. It's a value judgment, that one, isn't it? Some of you might go for the Good Samaritan, some of you might, I mean, it could be though, it's a great one, isn't it? But there is a greater story than that. It's not a story Jesus told. It's not a story in the sense of fiction. It's actually a story in terms of fact. It's a history, if you like. It's the story of God's love for the lost that saw his one and only Son come into this world and die as a punishment for our waywardness, our sinfulness, our arrogance, and our pride. So that we who are lost, prodigals and self-righteous, we who are lost can be found. We who are dead can be made alive. We can come home with joy and excitement. That's the greatest story. Jesus and his cross.